unnamed individual who said he wanted to expose criminal wrongdoing. The files were reviewed by a team of over 300 journalists over the course of a year prior to the coordinated publication of reports Sunday. The documents reveal that Mossack Fonseca, far from being an aberration, was an integral part of the operations of leading global banks. As ICIJ put it, quote, "The documents make it clear that major banks are big drivers behind the creation of hard-to-trace companies in the British Virgin Islands, Panama, and other offshore havens." The files list nearly 15,600 paper companies that banks set up for clients who want to keep their finances under wraps, including thousands created by international giants UBS and HSBC, end of quote. According to the ICIJ, among the services offered by the firm were the backdating of corporate documents and the destruction of evidence to prevent criminal prosecution. The company has denied involvement in any criminal activity. Sunday's revelations follow a release of documents by the ICIJ in 2015 that showed that the Swiss private banking arm of HSBC, Europe's largest bank, functioned for years as a tax evasion and money laundering firm. The company ran a branch that gave out, quote, "bricks of hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash in foreign denominations and provided its wealthy clientele with advice on how to commit tax fraud," according to the reports. The ICIJ report provides extensive documentation of the claims by University of California economist Gabriel Zucman, who has estimated that 8% of global financial wealth, amounting to some $7.6 trillion, is hidden in offshore tax havens. Quote, "These findings show how deeply ingrained harmful practices and criminality are in the offshore world," Zucman said in response to the reports. One leak exposed a global web of over 200,000 offshore shell companies. Imagine what leaks at other well-placed law firms and banks would expose, end of quote. Mark Williams, a lecturer at Boston University, told Bloomberg, "This leak is proof that despite explicit banking laws against tax evasion, criminal uses and money laundering, the global offshore shell game business remains open for the wealthy and well-connected," end of quote. While the US was the fourth most popular country for the shell company set up by Mossack Fonseca to operate, no high-profile individuals in the US were exposed as having had accounts. Some experts speculated that this was simply because of the fact that with extremely limited financial regulation, particularly in some state and local jurisdictions, wealthy Americans wishing to hide their assets or launder money can easily do so at home. Shaima Baradaran Bauman, a law professor, University of Utah College of Law, told Fusion, "Americans can form shell companies right in Wyoming, Delaware, or Nevada. They have no need to go to Panama to form a shell company to use for illicit activities," end of quote. US, NATO, preparing new air and ground attacks against Libya, by Thomas Gaist. The US and NATO are considering another round of military attacks against Libya, US President Barack Obama told media outside the White House on Monday. Obama gave a convoluted statement to the effect that operations in Libya are in advanced stages of planning. quote, "We are continuing to cooperate on an ongoing basis about operations potentially in areas like Libya, where you have the beginnings of a government," he said, after meeting with NATO General Secretary Jens Stoltenberg at the White House. "We can, I think, provide enormous help in helping to stabilize those countries," Obama added. "This is obviously a tumultuous time in the world. Europe is a focal point of a lot of these stresses and strains in the global security system," Obama said. Obama's talks with Stoltenberg centered on the possible US-NATO escalation in Libya and joint operations to contain the fallout from the refugee crisis in the eastern Mediterranean, according to Reuters. Stoltenberg signaled that NATO forces are on high alert for possible missions against Libya. Quote, "NATO stands ready to provide support to the new government in Libya," he said. Also on Monday, media agencies reported that US military planners with Africa Command, or AFRICOM, are drawing up detailed target lists for strikes in Libya, including targets in Ajabiya, Sabratha, and Derna. The Pentagon is, quote, "seeking to improve coordination between US Special Operations Forces and their French and British counterparts, which have established small cells on the ground, seeking in part to line up friendly militias," the Washington Post reported. The new governing coalition in Libya, formed last December and headed by Fayez al-Sarraj, was created for the purpose of immediately requesting military assistance from its imperialist patrons, a request that can be used to justify the indefinite continuation of the Western powers' quote, "robust UN mandate," authorizing air, sea, and land attacks against Libya in the name of quote, "international security." The US and European powers are preparing an intervention that will center on a drive to retake the capital of Tripoli and secure control over key oil infrastructure. Once the country's vast oil wealth is safely in hand, Washington is prepared to accept the permanent partition of Libya into a patchwork of armed groups, with a US-backed coalition presiding over only the skeleton of a centralized state. As the Post wrote Monday, quote, "US officials envision a gradual absorption of militia forces into a new national army, or at least a network of state-backed regional or tribal forces," end of quote. Italy appears set to play a leading role, vowing to contribute half of the necessary resources and to lead a ground invasion of its former colony. The invasion is planned to include thousands of Italian troops, backed up by thousands more drawn from other NATO powers, for a total of as many as 6,000 ground forces. As yet, there are still no, quote, "concrete military commitments to support the NATO-backed governing alliance," according to the Post. Nonetheless, there are clear signs that the US military is committed to deeper US ground involvement in Libya as part of stepped-up US special operations throughout Africa. Libya is only one of a handful of African hotspots where the US is preparing, quote, "unique special operations solutions," US Army General Tony Thomas told Congress in March. Following a hypothetical seizure of Tripoli, US commandos will link up with militant forces already active in the area, recruiting them as allies of the fledgling unity government, Thomas said. Plans for new military strikes and a ground invasion come 5 years after the NATO war to oust the regime of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. As part of this operation, the US and European powers backed Islamic extremist forces, including Al-Qaeda elements and precursors of Islamic State. The six-month NATO bombing campaign reduced entire cities to rubble. The very Islamist militias whose actions now form the supposed justification for the US-NATO intervention emerged out of groups that were armed and financed as a means to overthrow Gaddafi and kick-start a new round of imperialist wars of conquest in Africa and the Middle East. As the World Socialist website noted in March of 2011, as the war was getting underway, the, quote, Libyan Revolution was in reality a cover for the, quote, rape of Libya by a syndicate of imperialist powers determined to lay hold of its oil wealth and turn its territory into a neo-colonial base of operations for further interventions throughout the Middle East and North Africa, end of quote. Faced with the catastrophe created by their own actions, the imperialist powers are again placing Libya in the crosshairs, even as they expand operations in Iraq, Syria, and throughout the Middle East. Also today on the World Socialist website, IMF report points to sources of increasing financial turbulence by Nick Beams. Syriza and European Union begin mass deportations from Greece by Johannes Stern. US Navy prepares third provocation in South China Sea by Peter Simmons. Australian Government Crisis Intensifies Over Austerity Agenda by Mike Head. Why is the CIA putting bombs on Virginia school buses? By Nick Barrickman. Family seeks answers after homeless man dies in New Hampshire jail by Kate Randall. Mexican Nissan workers in two-day strike by Shannon Jones. US-backed Colombian peace treaty grants impunity for war crimes by Neil Hart. Canadian spy agency regularly using new, quote, disruption powers by Roger Jordan. Last-minute efforts to form a government in Ireland before Parliament resumes by Dermot Quinn. Indian Stalinists ally with regional DMDK party in Tamil Nadu elections by V. Nana. Under commentary, the political agenda behind the racial politics of the New York Times' Nicholas Krissoff by Niles Williamson. Under science, study warns of potentially catastrophic impacts from Antarctic Ice Melt by Daniel DeVries. Under Arts Review, UK documentary exposes Saudi role in global terror operations by Jean Shao. And under Workers' Struggles, court issues restraining order after New Mexico school bus drivers vote to strike by D. Lenchel. Australia, State Electricity Workers Vote for Industrial Action by Terry Cook. You can find all this and more today on the World Socialist website, wsws.org. This has been Perla Astadillo for the World Socialist website.
The World Socialist website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.
Coming up next, Informativo Pacifica.
A continuación, Informativo Pacifica.
No te la pierdas.
Because we are the 99%.
Tanta solidaridad, tanta movilización y tanta preocupación por la lucha de los pueblos, por la preocupación de lo que enfrentan los pueblos contra este poder.
Regresa a México el activista Gustavo Castro, sobreviviente y testigo del asesinato de la líder hondureña Berta Cáceres.
Y a pesar de que el nombre del mandatario no aparece en ninguno de los documentos filtrados, es el dato en que se han centrado casi exclusivamente medios occidentales, que al tiempo prestan poca atención a las figuras implicadas en sus propios países.
Empresario narcotraficante, políticos y otras personas cercanas al poder lavan dinero y ocultan fortunas en paraísos fiscales, revelan documentos filtrados a la prensa internacional.
Estamos felices por tener la posibilidad de navegar dentro del área de 9 millas náuticas, pero las cosas siguen estando difíciles.
Israel expande a 9 millas náuticas la zona de pesca en la Franja de Gaza. A continuación, detalles de estas y otras noticias en esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Te saluda Fernando Velázquez. Quédate con nosotros. Daremos comienzo a esta edición del Informativo Pacífica con un segmento de notas breves producido por Norma Martínez.
Empresarios, narcotraficantes, vendedores de armas, presidentes, políticos y otras figuras públicas y cercanas al poder lavan dinero y ocultan fortunas en paraísos fiscales para evadir el pago de impuestos en sus respectivos países. Así lo revelan 11 millones y medio de documentos internos de la empresa Mossack Fonseca, filtrados por un despacho de abogados panameño a un periódico alemán. Se trataría de la mayor filtración en el mundo, superando incluso las revelaciones de Edward Snowden. Los compañeros de Telesur informan sobre algunos de los clientes de la empresa panameña Mossack Fonseca.
Los documentos que muestran vínculos con 72 jefes de Estado fueron obtenidos por el diario alemán Süddeutsche Zeitung y compartidos con el Consorcio Internacional de Periodistas de Investigación. 107 medios de comunicación en 78 países intervinieron en su análisis. Entre las personalidades mencionadas se encuentran el primer ministro de Islandia Sigmund David Gunnlaugsson, el rey de Arabia Saudita Abdullah bin Abdelaziz Al Saud, el presidente argentino Mauricio Macri, el actual presidente ucraniano Pietro Poroshenko o el presidente de los Emiratos Árabes Unidos, Khalifa bin Zayed bin Sultan Al Nahyan. También los primeros ministros de Georgia, Jordania, Qatar, un ex vicepresidente iraquí, un ex emir de Qatar, un ex presidente de Sudán y el condenado ex primer ministro ucraniano Pavel Larasenko. También menciona a los hermanos Pedro y Agustín Almodóvar, el futbolista Lionel Messi, así como miembros de familia allegados a líderes políticos, como la tía del rey de España, Felipe VI, hermana de Juan Carlos de Borbón. En la lista aparecen amigos íntimos del presidente de Rusia, Vladimir Putin, y a pesar de que el nombre del mandatario no aparece en ninguno de los documentos filtrados, es el dato en que se han centrado casi exclusivamente medios occidentales, que al tiempo prestan poca atención a las figuras implicadas en sus propios países.
En lo que se ha dado por llamar Panama Papers se incluyen un gran número de funcionarios mexicanos, empresarios y personalidades cercanas al poder. La revista Proceso, que participó en el análisis de los documentos de la empresa panameña, asegura en un reportaje que abogados y especialistas les han ayudado a crear compañías de papel, fideicomisos, sociedades y fundaciones en un laberinto de estructuras internacionales en las que se perdía la pista del dinero y la identidad de los dueños. Sobresalen entre los empresarios mexicanos que ocultan dinero en el exterior los que han hecho fortunas con fondos públicos a través de contratos con el Estado mexicano, como el dueño del grupo IGA, Juan Armando Hinojosa, el dueño de TV Azteca, Ricardo Salinas Pliego y otros contratistas con la paraestatal Pemex. El contratista favorito del presidente Enrique Peña Nieto, Hinojosa Cantú, habría ocultado unos 100 millones de dólares cuando salió a la luz pública que vendió de manera opaca a la primera dama, la lujosa Casa Blanca. El secretario de Hacienda y responsable de la recaudación fiscal, Luis Videgaray, quien a su vez adquirió una mansión de Hinojosa, rechazó el lunes contestar preguntas de la prensa. Otro empresario que la firma panameña describe como una de las personas más poderosas de México es Ramiro García Cantú, quien ha hecho su fortuna como contratista por más de 30 años al amparo de la paraestatal Pemex. Los socios de Oceanografía, empresa que fue favorecida por el gobierno de Felipe Calderón con millonarios contratos con Pemex, también usan el entramado internacional de ocultamiento de dinero. La revista Proceso señala que este hecho no sería posible sin la participación de los bancos que fungen en muchos casos como accionistas de las empresas creadas en los paraísos fiscales. Para el caso de México, los archivos muestran la presencia de Santander Private Banking, HSBC Private Banking, Credit Suisse First Boston y la calificadora Mary Lynch. El nombre del presidente de Argentina también aparece en los Panama Papers, que consignan tuvo una empresa en las Bahamas y no informó de ella en sus declaraciones juradas. Mauricio Macri enfrenta protestas desde su llegada al poder por ordenar despidos masivos de empleados públicos, aumentar en más de 300% los costos del agua y la electricidad, condonar impuestos a mineras y decidir aumentar la deuda nacional para pagar unos 5,000 millones de dólares a los fondos buitre estadounidenses. Informa Pepe Frutos desde el Foro Argentino de Radios Comunitarias.
El presidente Mauricio Macri tuvo una empresa en las Bahamas y no la informó en sus declaraciones juradas. Así lo reveló una investigación periodística difundida a nivel mundial, realizada por el Consorcio Internacional de Periodismo de Investigación. Esta investigación se realizó mediante el análisis de más de 11 millones de documentos de un estudio de abogados con sede en Panamá que se dedicaba a crear empresas fantasmas en los denominados paraísos o guaridas fiscales, que son pequeños países que facilitan estas prácticas que permiten la evasión de impuestos y el lavado de dinero. Estamos en contacto telefónico con el economista Andrés Aciaín del Centro de Estudios Escalabrini Ortiz. ¿Qué son esto de los paraísos fiscales y para qué se puede llegar a crear una empresa en un país como Bahamas?
Una operatoria normal económica y de cara a la sociedad no necesita ocultarse en paraísos fiscales, ¿no? Estos lugares fueron creados justamente para eludir las regulaciones de los distintos gobiernos nacionales y en general se vincula a que son, bueno, lugares donde no se informa que vos tenés una cuenta o una empresa, donde no hay regulaciones impositivas y en general se usa o para eludir impuestos o para movilizar plata que de origen, podemos decir, no lícito, ¿no? Se ha ligado al narcotráfico, se ha ligado a algún negocio ilegal o, bueno, de la evasión impositiva.
Y desde el gobierno nacional reconocieron que Macri fue administrador de esa empresa en las Bahamas, pero argumentaron que no la declaró porque no tenía participación en el capital accionario. Entre otros argentinos que figuran en empresas, en paraísos fiscales, y que fueron revelados por esta investigación, figuran famosos como el futbolista Lionel Messi o también funcionarios como el intendente de Lanús, Néstor Grindetti, y el exsecretario de Néstor Kirchner y Cristina Fernández, Daniel Muñoz. Como decíamos, el presidente Mauricio Macri tenía una empresa en las Bahamas hasta el año 2009 y no la informó en sus declaraciones juradas. Junto a él estaban como titulares de esta empresa su padre y su hermano.
El diario alemán que recibió los Panama Papers reiteró su negativa a entregar a las autoridades los datos sobre los paraísos fiscales a nivel mundial filtrados de un despacho panameño de abogados. Frederick Obermeier, uno de los periodistas que investigó los documentos, declaró a la agencia DPA que la fiscalía cuenta con los recursos para indagar sobre la información. Otra cosa es si hacen uso de ellos, señaló. En Noticias de México, la educación pública, la salud y la agricultura serán los principales sectores afectados por los recortes al presupuesto anunciados para el 2017 por el gobierno de Peña Nieto, informa el diario La Jornada. Autoridades griegas iniciaron el lunes la deportación a Turquía de refugiados que intentaban adentrarse al territorio europeo. Así cumplen un acuerdo entre la Unión Europea y Turquía. Los primeros refugiados fueron trasladados de las islas griegas de Lesbos hacia ciudades turcas acompañados de buques guardacostas. Europa y Estados Unidos le cierran las puertas a millones de refugiados de los conflictos que crearon con la invasión de Afganistán, Irak y la estrategia de cambio de régimen en Libia y Siria. Las minas terrestres matan a un promedio de 10 personas al día, aseguró el secretario general de la ONU. En un mensaje con motivo del Día Internacional de Información sobre el peligro de las minas, Ban Ki-moon dijo estar especialmente preocupado por el uso de esas armas en las zonas pobladas. Aseguró que son los civiles y no los combatientes los que se ven más afectados por las minas, las bombas de racimo y los explosivos improvisados.
A pesar de la firma por parte de 162 países de la Convención sobre la Prohibición de las Minas Antipersonales en 1999, el Servicio de la ONU para la Acción contra las Minas, el UNMAS, advirtió que estos explosivos siguen representando una realidad diaria para la población civil. Bruno Donat es su portavoz. Las minas terrestres siguen matando al menos a 10 personas al día en todo el mundo y causando graves lesiones en muchísimas más. El 40% de estas muertes son niños. En Sudán del Sur, 14 millones de metros cuadrados de tierra han sido desminadas en el último año y en Siria se han destruido desde agosto 14 toneladas de explosivos no detonados. En América Latina, el país más afectado es Colombia. Carlota Fluxá, Naciones Unidas, Nueva York.
Las Fuerzas Armadas Revolucionarias de Colombia, FARC, alertaron sobre el incremento de acciones de grupos paramilitares de extrema derecha. En un comunicado exigieron al gobierno de Juan Manuel Santos desmantelar a quienes califican de escuadrones de la muerte, que están ensombreciendo los avances en los diálogos de paz, dicen. Las FARC denunciaron un frustrado atentado contra la gestora por la paz y ex senadora Piedad Córdoba. La guerrilla señaló que las acciones paramilitares se dirigen contra la población civil y líderes políticos y sociales desarmados. El fin de semana, la extrema derecha, liderada por el expresidente Álvaro Uribe y su partido Centro Democrático, se movilizó en decenas de ciudades colombianas para rechazar las negociaciones de paz entre la guerrilla y el gobierno. El propio Uribe ha sido vinculado a grupos paramilitares, así como sus familiares y exintegrantes de su gobierno. Decenas de miles de trabajadores de la educación, estudiantes y padres de familia de Chicago realizaron el viernes un paro de 24 horas para exigir mayor presupuesto al tercer sistema escolar público más grande de Estados Unidos. Los profesores de Chicago, que continúan la negociación de su contrato laboral, han denunciado que las autoridades locales, encabezadas por el alcalde demócrata Rahm Emanuel, intentan privatizar la enseñanza pública como en el resto del país. El activista Gustavo Castro, único testigo del asesinato de la líder indígena hondureña Berta Cáceres, regresó a México después de que las autoridades de Honduras levantaran una orden judicial para que permaneciera en ese país. El coordinador de la organización Otros Mundos, Amigos de la Tierra México, que resultó herido en el ataque del pasado 2 de marzo, denunció el lunes en conferencia de prensa la lentitud de las autoridades mexicanas para intervenir en su favor. Antes de salir de Honduras, Gustavo Castro dio una entrevista a los compañeros de Radio Progreso, donde agradeció el apoyo nacional e internacional para lograr el regreso a su patria.
Es increíble tanta solidaridad, tanta movilización y tanta preocupación, no solamente por mí, sino preocupación por la lucha de los pueblos, por la preocupación de lo que enfrentan los pueblos contra este poder tan ambicioso que quiere despojar de los territorios a los pueblos, a las comunidades indígenas, campesinas, garífunas. Y este trabajo y este movimiento de toda una sociedad internacional por todos lados, cada quien desde sus trincheras, luchando por la justicia, luchando porque haya otros mundos sean posibles, con dignidad, con respeto a los derechos humanos. Y nos estamos enfrentando todas y todos pues a un poder muy fuerte. Y yo creo que, pero con el asesinato de Bertita, como que ese espíritu renació por todos lados. Y algo impresionante fue cómo generó tanta unidad en todos lados.
Gustavo Castro explicó que el 2 de marzo se encontraba en la vivienda de Berta Cáceres, la cofundadora del Consejo Cívico de Organizaciones Populares e Indígenas de Honduras, COPIN, porque iba a hablarle a su familia.
A veces pienso que como que el destino me había dado la oportunidad de ser yo quien me despidiera de Berta.
¿Cómo fue ese momento?
Pues muy doloroso. Fue un momento en que pues Berta se fue en un rato, en un minuto. Pero yo creo que pues que el destino me dio la oportunidad de vivir para que ese legado de Berta no quedara sepultado como pretenden hacerlo todavía. Ni tampoco el legado del COPIN, que hubiera sido acabado, que hubiera sido masacrado. Y yo creo que nos escogió a todos, no solamente a mí, al equipo legal y a mucha gente, sino a la gente en México y a muchos movimientos y organizaciones y redes. Yo fui solamente como un vehículo para juntar fuerzas y para juntar unidad y para juntar las voces pues de justicia, para juntar las voces y que ese legado de Berta y ese legado del COPIN no fueran sepultados, sino que más bien pues se sembró. Berta no murió, Berta no se sepultó, Berta se sembró.
La entrevista completa con Gustavo Castro puede ser escuchada en nuestro blog en pueblosinfronteras.wordpress.com.
Ese segmento de Notas Breves fue elaborado por Norma Martínez. Más de 150 medios de comunicación alrededor del mundo optaron el lunes por repetir una historia del diario El Guardián de Londres sobre un supuesto hackeo al banco de datos de Mossack Fonseca, un despacho legal de Panamá. Las agencias noticiosas aseguran que gobiernos alrededor del mundo han iniciado investigaciones sobre posibles violaciones de las leyes por parte de los ricos y poderosos, aunque admiten que los documentos obtenidos ilegalmente de Panamá cubren actividades de más de 40 años e incluyen numerosas personas importantes. Al frente de la lista de nombres está el presidente ruso Vladimir Putin, familiares de los primeros ministros de Bretaña, Islandia, Pakistán y el primer mandatario de Ucrania. Wayne Madsen es editor del sitio digital waynemadsenreport.com, entidad con sede en Washington, Distrito de Columbia.
The way the news media reported this story is that the circumstantial indirect.
Él dice que los medios cubrieron la nota hablando de que personas involucradas con Mossack Fonseca estaban asociados o quizá conocían a Vladimir Putin y al presidente chino Xi Jinping. Por tanto, ambos estaban implicados. El caso es que hicieron eso a sabiendas de que ni el líder chino ni el líder ruso estaban directamente involucrados.
And where we have absolute evidence of personal involvement is from individuals like Mauricio Macri.
Madsen señala que donde hay evidencia absoluta de involucramiento es con Mauricio Macri, el derechista fascista y nuevo presidente de Argentina, dice, aparentemente el mejor amigo de Barack Obama. Pero el nombre de Macri no apareció en la fase inicial de la cobertura de todos esos grandes medios ingleses, alemanes o australianos, acota Madsen. Los periodistas que obtuvieron los documentos robados dicen que estos proveen evidencia sobre evasión fiscal, lavado de dinero, transacciones sobre drogas y otros crímenes. Los reportes tienen como fuente el Consorcio de Periodistas Investigativos, entidad con sede en los Estados Unidos.
This group, the International Consortium for Investigative Journalists, one goes to their website and looks at the bottom.
En cuanto al Consorcio de Periodistas Investigativos, a cargo de seleccionar e interpretar el material obtenido de Mossack Fonseca, Madsen dice que si uno se asoma a su sitio web, se da cuenta que está financiado por la Open Society Foundation, ese es el otro nombre para el magnate George Soros, además por la USAID, y ese es otro nombre para la Agencia Central de Inteligencia Norteamericana. La empresa Mossack Fonseca responde a la cobertura mediática del asunto diciendo que ellos no están haciendo nada malo y que están siendo víctimas de una campaña contra su privacidad. Claramente esto es una operación psicológica, dice Madsen. El presidente sirio Bashar al-Assad no está vinculado a estas transacciones, ni tampoco estaba el difunto líder libio Muammar Gaddafi. En esencia, Este es un golpe barato dirigido a Putin de Rusia y a Xi Jinping de China. Weymassen dice que su mayor problema de la historia es con los periodistas que le siguieron el juego, a quien la está empujando, pues todavía no han tenido acceso a los documentos. Ellos solo están repitiendo nombres de personas seleccionados de una vasta cantidad de información, como ocurriera anteriormente con las revelaciones de WikiLeaks. Como ejemplo, el investigador dice que cuando se reportó la noticia sobre WikiLeaks, esta se centró en Irán y había un profundo silencio sobre comentarios de los diplomáticos estadounidenses en Tel Aviv.
This is another opportunity with the Panama Papers to slam Dilma Rousseff.
Maston subraya que la filtración de estos documentos sirve para atacar a la presidenta de Brasil, Dilma Rousseff, y al líder brasileño Lula da Silva, y por extensión, es una jugada diseñada para golpear al grupo de los BRICS.
When I start seeing maybe names of Obama cabinet,
Weymassen concluye diciendo que cuando él empiece a ver revelaciones sobre actos de corrupción de miembros del gabinete presidencial de Barack Obama, secretarios, senadores y gente del Departamento de Estado en los documentos de Panamá, entonces le dará un poco de crédito a la noticia. En tanto, solo la mira como un acto de vendedores de aceite de víbora, una vieja expresión coloquial que quiere decir una persona que vende un producto que, en el mejor de los casos, su calidad está inflada y, en el peor, se trata de un fraude. Elena Villar, desde España, nos informa sobre algunas revelaciones que apuntan a personajes bien conocidos en esa nación europea en relación a los papeles de Panamá.
Al menos 1.200 sociedades y más de 500 accionistas con dirección postal en España aparecen en esos documentos investigados. De momento se desconocen las cantidades invertidas y si fueron declaradas o no Hacienda. Esto es importante puesto que hay que tener en cuenta que España, para España, Panamá no es un paraíso fiscal. Aún así, se ha abierto una investigación aquí en España por parte de la Fiscalía de la Audiencia Nacional y también por parte de la Agencia Tributaria. Entre las personalidades hay gente de todo tipo. Una de ellas es Pilar de Borbón, es hermana del rey Juan Carlos y, por tanto, tía de Felipe VI. Fue propietaria, fue directora de una sociedad en Panamá desde el año 74, una sociedad que se disolvió tan solo 5 días después de la proclamación de Felipe VI como último monarca de España. También hay gente de otras esferas, por ejemplo, de la cultura. Los hermanos Almodóvar también están en esos papeles investigados. En teoría, también ellos, vía Panamá, abrieron una empresa en las Islas Vírgenes Británicas. Este sí es un territorio considerado por España como paraíso fiscal. Aún así, en un comunicado han asegurado que lo hicieron por indicación de sus asesores fiscales. Otros, por ejemplo, la familia Domecq, una familia de empresarios andaluces muy conocida. Una de ellos, de los 12 implicados de esa familia, es la esposa del comisario europeo Miguel Arias Cañete. Y finalmente, también por destacar otra de las personalidades, está el futbolista argentino Leo Messi y su padre. Se investiga si desde el año 2013 lo que hicieron fue formar parte de ese entramado, crear una sociedad en Panamá para gestionar sus derechos de imagen. Aquí lo que se pone de manifiesto en el caso de Leo Messi es que se habría producido tan solo un día después de que la Agencia Tributaria denunciara una presunta evasión fiscal de más de 4 millones de euros por parte del futbolista Leo Messi, una presunta evasión fiscal que, hay que recordar, todavía sigue en manos de la justicia española.
Ignacio Jubilla nos informa desde la República Argentina.
El nombre de Messi, ha sido uno de los nombres de los argentinos que figura en esta lista, ha causado muchísimo revuelo, por supuesto, aquí en el país. Quien ha salido a responder ha sido su padre, Jorge Messi, que es además su representante y quien maneja los negocios del jugador. Dijo que todo esto es una mentira que se está creando a partir de algo que él define como totalmente transparente, y amenaza con iniciar acciones legales contra los periodistas que publicaron esta información. El nombre de Messi no es el único de la comunidad deportiva que ha sido mencionado aquí en la Argentina, también el del jugador Gabriel Heinze, otro jugador Leonardo Ulloa. Se menciona a Juniors en los documentos y también a dos empresarios que están relacionados con el FIFA Gate. Todo esto respecto a las figuras deportivas, decíamos, pero sin lugar a dudas que lo que más conmoción ha causado es que el nombre del presidente Mauricio Macri sea el de uno de los muy pocos mandatarios que son mencionados directamente en estos papeles. Macri figura junto a su hermano Mariano y a su padre Franco como director de una empresa, la empresa Fleck Trading, que funcionó hasta el año 2009, y eso nunca fue declarado en ninguna de sus declaraciones juradas. ¿Qué ha respondido el gobierno mediante un comunicado? Y también la vicepresidenta de la Nación, han dicho que Macri era director de esa empresa porque era una empresa familiar, pero que no tenía movimiento de activos porque ni siquiera cobraba un sueldo y por eso no fue incluido en las declaraciones juradas. Sin embargo, se está pidiendo desde todo el arco político aquí de la oposición también que el presidente dé mayores explicaciones. Los temas basta de corrupción y papeles de Panamá son tendencia en estos momentos en las redes sociales en la Argentina, habida cuenta de que hay otros funcionarios también que fueron mencionados. Uno de ellos también es un intendente, un jefe de gobierno de una localidad del partido oficialista y también un ex secretario del matrimonio Kirchner.
Emma Torres nos comparte algunos detalles desde la Ciudad de México.
Aquí en México, uno de los nombres más importantes que surgió desde esa investigación es Armando Hinojosa Cantú, dueño de Grupo IGA. Este nombre que se hiciera famoso cuando se dio a conocer la llamada Casa Blanca, esta investigación que destapaba una casa que había sido comprada en beneficio del presidente del país. Se sabe que él movilizó al menos 100 millones de dólares desde Estados Unidos hasta Nueva Zelanda y que usaba a su madre y a su suegra, ambas de más de 80 años de edad, para hacer estos movimientos. También ha trascendido el nombre de Ricardo Salinas Pliego, dueño de la segunda televisora más importante del país, presidente de TV Azteca, quien ha realizado operaciones en paraísos fiscales desde 2004, presumiblemente para comprar obras de arte y también yates. Suenan otros nombres: Guillermo Cañedo White, ex ejecutivo de Televisa y vicepresidente de la CONCACAF. Otro ejecutivo también de Televisa, Alfonso de Angoitia, ha resultado en esta investigación. Se sabe que él, como actual vicepresidente ejecutivo y vicepresidente del Comité de Finanzas de Grupo Televisa, en 2015 compró UCTEL, una empresa en las Bahamas que está incluida como un paraíso fiscal.
En otras noticias, Israel ha expandido a 9 millas náuticas la zona de pesca en las costas de la Franja de Gaza, decisión que entró en vigencia la tarde del domingo. Nur Harsin reporta.
Los pescadores gazatíes podrán navegar ahora dentro de un área de 9 millas náuticas desde el Valle de Gaza hacia el sur. Esta decisión de Israel de expandir la zona de pesca en ciertas áreas de la Franja de Gaza entró en vigencia en la tarde del domingo. Fuentes oficiales del Ministerio Civil de Palestina confirmaron que el acuerdo alcanzado con las autoridades palestinas también permite la entrada de materiales de mantenimiento necesarios para reparar los equipos de pesca que en muchos casos han sido dañados por la Armada israelí.
Estamos felices por tener la posibilidad de navegar dentro del área de 9 millas náuticas, pero las cosas siguen estando difíciles. Hubo un momento en el que nos rodearon, los botes estaban muy cerca uno del otro y no había suficiente espacio para pescar bien. Tampoco había mucho pescado. Esperamos ahora que las zonas de pesca sean expandidas a 12 millas náuticas para poder pescar más y mejorar nuestra deteriorada situación económica.
Under the Oslo Agreements in 1990s. El rango de pesca fue establecido en 20 millas náuticas, luego de los acuerdos de Oslo, firmados en los 90, pero con el paso de los años, Israel ha ido reduciendo este rango, afectando gravemente el sustento de miles de pescadores quienes dependen de este negocio. Desde ese entonces, la mayoría de los peces se encuentran fuera de ese límite. Desde el 2006, las autoridades israelíes han permitido que los pescadores del enclave asediado lleven a cabo sus actividades de pesca dentro de un límite de 4 millas náuticas por medidas de seguridad. Sin embargo, han sido atacados en varias oportunidades por las Fuerzas Armadas israelíes. El año pasado, solamente el Centro de Palestinos para los Derechos Humanos reportó cerca de 139 violaciones por parte de la Armada israelí contra los pescadores palestinos dentro de la zona de pesca permitida. Entre las violaciones se encuentra el asesinato de 3 pescadores, docenas de heridos y al menos 16 botes destruidos.
Is still far from the 20-mile limit again.
Nur Harasim, Telesur, Gaza.
Aquí concluye esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Agradecemos la colaboración de todas las personas que hicieron posible este programa, el mismo que es producido gracias a las generosas donaciones de las y los radioyentes. A nombre de Toshli y de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
This is Freak Radio Santa Cruz. Fuck the FCC.
And coming up next on Free Radio, it is Bathrobes, Beers, Broadsides, your twice weekly fun, fun, fun show with lots of local information, or some anyway. It's pre-recorded, and it's got a little Phil Oaks intro, so let's jump in. Today is April 7th, 2016.
I found a small circle of friends, sweating in the ghetto with the colored and the poor. The rats would join the babies who are sleeping on the floor. Now wouldn't it be a riot if they really blew their tops? But they got too much already, and besides we've got the cops. And I'm sure it wouldn't interest anybody outside of a small circle of friends. Oh, look outside the window, there's a woman being grabbed. They've dragged her to the bushes, and now she's being stabbed. Maybe we should call the cops and try to stop the pain. But Monopoly is so much fun, I'd hate to blow the game. And I'm sure it wouldn't interest anybody outside of a small circle of friends.
So I'm doing my shorter show, which is the Thursday evening show tonight, and it's going to be a mostly, well, almost entirely flashbacks. And we're going to flash back to 1988, material never before played on Free Radio. In the fall of 1988, there was a great surge of homeless activism in Santa Cruz. After a summer of petitioning the city council and finding them deaf to reason and human compassion, something we found again in 2016 over the same issue, the right to sleep, not anywhere and everywhere, but somewhere, we began civil disobedient protests, which involved a lot of court action, involved a lot of organizing. It also involved a lot of media attention. And what I'm going to play for you are two media accounts by alternative media, admittedly, KZSC, two interviews. The first one is with a couple of UCSC students, Jenny and Marie, activist Charles Gray, myself, and then-attorney, now-legal-worker, Ray Glock-Grunike, who was then Ray Grunike. These folks were actively involved in risking arrest to dramatize to the community the abusive policies of the police department, the city council, the city manager, and the city bureaucracy generally, as is the case today, against homeless folks. The second interview, and I'm going to play these back to back, is a somewhat more difficult to hear interview because one of the interviewees, Jane Immler, or Calamity Jane as we like to call her, sort of had a hoarse throat that day. But her companion, Brian Koepke, or Bubba Brian, as I called him, who then later became sort of second in charge of the free meal under Karen Gillette out at the Coral Street area, which then devolved into the homeless lack of services center, which is the concentration camp that now exists out there. It's a shorter interview, and both of them give you a real, I think, vivid and practical sense of, well, hopefully also an inspirational sense of what it meant to be a homeless activist, for some folks anyway, during those times. So listen in and be inspired.
Or just for anything that comes up. Right now we're focusing on having the sleeping ban repealed. We'd also like a moratorium placed on the tickets, and we'd like to have campsites set up. Okay. And that's basically what we're aiming for. And Maria's also involved with me in that.
Have you gotten any reaction from the campus, from the chancellor and from the chancellor's office?
No, not currently. We're going through the process of becoming an organization, but we're having a lot of positive student input from it. A lot of people don't know this type of thing's going on, and you inform them of it, and they're like appalled that we could be ticketing people who, you know, asking money from people don't have money to begin with. So it is very contradictory.
Okay. In the case with Linda Edwards, Ray, she got the $50 fine that was suspended. Has that been the procedure down the board?
Yeah, actually, there have been a couple cases with Linda Edwards that illustrate homeless problems. Our first case was a Greyhound Rock incident, but we can maybe mention that a little bit later. I wrote a little article in the Street Sheet called "The Constitution Visits Greyhound Rock," but. The second case, the one that you're referring to, is the one that occupied the courts for several weeks, ultimately. And ultimately, the sentence was a $50 suspended fine. Another one of our defendants, Maria Leal, submitted a no-contest plea to one of the City Hall sleep-ins. And she was likewise given a $50 suspended fine. As a prediction, it would seem that at least in Judge Attuck's court, for the sleep-in demonstrations that have already occurred, I would expect him to come out with uniformity of sentence. However, I would caution that people should not commit new demonstrations that could be construed as civil disobedience with the expectation that that would necessarily be the continuing sentence. I would suspect that they might up the ante, and people should assume, as they always should, when something could be construed as civil disobedience, that they might have to pay a stiff penalty for it. And I say that partly because part of our argument for a lenient penalty, and I think one that Judge Attuck was very responsive to, was the idea that it was necessary to bring this case into court to test these theories, to test the for whether or not such demonstrations were in fact covered by the First Amendment. We've had our first answer from one judge on one state of facts in the Edwards case, and that answer was a negative one from our perspective. We certainly do intend to appeal Edwards to the next highest level. And furthermore, even as to Judge Attuck's courtroom, we have some other evidence that we hope to bring in the subsequent cases that I think may very well produce the opposite verdict from Judge Attuck himself. Because of some of the technical grounds upon which Judge Attuck based his decision. So I'll again defer that and come back to it later after other folks have had more of their say.
Okay. Robert, pardon me. Robert, you're the editor, I guess, of the Street Sheet. And you're also involved last week in what you consider a violation of your First Amendment rights. Could you go into that and explain that to us?
Yeah, as far as I know about it, the police apparently got an arrest warrant, to pick me up for what's called false information, which in this case meant that my birth name, which is the name of my driver's license, but not the name that I customarily use and have used for the last 10 to 12 years, is not the same as my name in use. And they used this as what I regarded as a pretext for grabbing me right before the city council meeting and arresting me, seizing signs that I happened to be near to, but which were not mine, that were going to be used at the city council meeting, protest signs, such as sleep is innocent, ban sleeping, why not ban eating next, things of this sort.
Okay.
They held me for 48 hours, or 44 hours, actually. And then when I was finally allowed to come before a judge, considerably later than previously, I'd been released on my own recognizance. They had arrested me at other city council meetings on other charges, which in their eyes, and not so much in mine, but I could see that they could have a legitimate sense. I was arrested for one case for disrupting an assembly, in which we were simply trying to assert our right to speak, and the mayor had cut short the time allowed people to discuss the issue. We felt that was unfair, and we continued to speak. Another occasion, they arrested me for sleeping outside the city council chambers, which was part of a sleep-in demonstration. And in both those instances, there was an issue that could be tried in court and will be tried in court. Those cases will be coming up. But in this case, false information, the charges were dismissed. It was used to hold me for an unusually long period of time, 44 hours. And there was a $2,000 bail set. And they gave out information to demonstrators at the time of the arrest that I was some kind of fraudulent person misrepresenting myself. It would seem to be an attempt to sow dissension among demonstrators and also to smear me before the public, which I hope will backfire because I intend to file a false arrest suit after making a claim to the city.
Okay.
Can I comment a little bit on that particular arrest of Roberts?
Certainly.
First of all, I want to say that I was not the attorney who represented Robert in connection with that arrest. Reed Shumps, a local attorney, did a very fine job. And the grounds upon which he was dismissed was a very appropriate ground that there was insufficient evidence to support the charge made under the that judgment was made by a deputy district attorney, Nguyen, who... it was his first contact with the case, and as soon as he had an opportunity to evaluate both the police report and other materials that were available through the local press, that Mr. Norris holds himself out as a Mr. Norris rather than by the name of his parents and has for a long time, did the obvious thing to do, drop the charges. What I would want to add to that is that that particular elementary lesson of what should be done is not new to Santa Cruz. It is well known. The most striking example that I can give right now is the case of another activist who I've had the privilege of representing in many occasions in this county and city, and that's of the feminist activist Nikki Kraft, who has literally undergone hundreds and hundreds of arrests around the country and probably at least 15 or so or more in Santa Cruz County. She consistently uses a name by which she is known by everyone as Nikki Kraft. However, the police and the courts are well aware that her birth name and her legal name was during this period of time Deborah Spray. Actually, she has since changed it legally, but that's all subsequent to Santa Cruz events. Police Chief Bassett, who helped to orchestrate the arrest in this particular case, knew that about Nikki Kraft, knew that her name was Deborah Spray, or her, not her name, but her birth name was Deborah Spray. I find it extremely interesting and most disturbing that somebody whose public policy would be favored in Santa Cruz by the Santa Cruz City Council, such as Nikki Kraft, and should be favored, that there would be no thought of prosecuting her for using a false name because she uses a name she's known by. But when you have a policy that is disfavored, such as agitation on behalf of the homeless, that suddenly now the so-called progressives and their allies start looking through for various forms of police repression that can be used to stifle this movement. That is dangerous. That is fascistic, regardless of what brand name it is superintended under.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Ray. We had a caller that apparently hung up. Please, if we're in the middle of a discussion, we're not going to cut in to talk to you, but please hold on and be patient and we'll get to you. Right about now, we have to do something that the FCC makes us do, and here we go.
Listen up. This is for your own good. The following program contains material of a sensitive, controversial, or sexual nature which may offend some members of the audience. The views expressed reflect those of the speaker only and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of KZSC or the UC Regents. Anyone who prefers not to hear this type of material should tune out KZSC for an indeterminate amount of time and join us later. Thank you very much.
Dreamed of riding horses, roping and herding cattle. Oh, how those brutes terrorized me when they saw my velvet saddle.
And I would like to get specific.
Okay, here we are. We're back again.
Specifically, legal technical terms of work.
Okay. Once again, Maria, could you tell us about your case and what happened with you?
Okay. On October 12th, I believe it was, a city council meeting was on October 11th. We were arrested after midnight. We were given tickets, which is an infraction. And we chose to stay at Town Hall, and we were again accosted by the police and given a misdemeanor charge, which is that $1,000 fine or 6 months in jail. And we were then taken to the police station, where I had my most interesting experience with the
county jail.
Yeah, the county jail, and we're put in holding tanks, and these tiny little rooms, and there was five of us in there, and before we got in there, the police were trying to play mind games with us, and
How do you mean mind games?
Like right when we got in there, when they were searching us, and we had to take off our earrings and anything that might hurt something. The two policemen that were doing this had a conversation going on together, and it was basically to deter me from any further action that I might have with this homeless issue.
How was that? What was the conversation like?
Just saying things like, do you read the papers? I'm all, yeah. And he said something in fact that, don't you know that the homeless people don't even want you out there? And making just remarks like that. And when I got in, I was kind of bummed about the whole situation. And I was just sitting there, and my friend who was with us at the time also came in and said that was exactly what they had just said to her. And they used those sort of tactics to deter us from protesting at any further time.
Okay, we've got a caller now. You're on the air with KZSC. Please tell us what you're thinking. Hello? Hello? Okay, apparently they weren't thinking much. if you're going to call, please call in. And if you've got a question, it's 429-4036. Please don't hang up. It's very upsetting. Okay, you can go ahead and continue then.
Well, we were released at 9 in the morning, at which time I think this was the first misdemeanor
sleeping arrest
ever. And there was four of us. Robert was with me, with another boy named John and Joanna Burton. And basically, I feel that the city council has put this label homeless on these people, and they've almost forgotten that they are people. And there are basic human rights that these people need, and they're not living up to that.
Okay, we've got another caller. Let's see what this person has to say. Please don't hang up. Hello? Hello? Okay. Wow, this is very upsetting. Do you suppose it's the city council? Okay, Charles, could you tell us a bit about your involvement with the Santa Cruz homeless?
Well, okay, I was kind of pulled into the issue a couple of years ago when there was a vigil at the town clock and a sleep-in, and at that time I was involved in projects related to Central America, and I only participated for a brief time, and though I slept overnight at the town clock, I wasn't arrested on that occasion. And then when some of the homeless folks, and especially Robert Norse, began organizing this past summer, why, the issue, which has always been kind of close to my heart, because I think it's a basic right that people have to sleep, and to sleep in the locality of their choice. You know, I mean, there's no, it seems to me there's absolutely no justification for saying that people should go elsewhere. If they choose to live here, that's their right as a human being. And so that's kind of my basic position, is that is simply an interest in the human rights of all citizens. And so anyway, I got drawn into kind of a peripheral role to present time, where I, part of the time, I'm able to help out in some way or other. And I did participate in a sleep-in and was arrested at the same one where Linda Edwards was arrested, in essentially the same situation. And I have a court date coming up this coming Monday, and I think I'm going to defend myself, and partly the reason for that is much as I appreciate the brilliant briefs of Ray here and the way he conducted the Linda Edwards case, I would like to bring up some things that in the court, if it's possible, bring up some things that, because I'm defending myself, might be a little more possible to bring up than when an attorney is defending me. And for example, I'm interested in what's called a necessity defense. A necessity defense is one where you say that you risked arrest for possible violation of a law in order to prevent a more serious crime from being committed. And in my view, the continued harassment of homeless people is a serious human rights crime. And it was that I was trying to stop by participating in a sleep-in, with the idea that an aroused public would put pressure on the city council and would stop this kind of harassment and deprivation of sleep that is involved in the harassment. So anyway, I would like to present that kind of a defense. Just how far I will get with that is unknown. But the another aspect of my defense is based on the Nuremberg Principles, or actually the same defense based on the Nuremberg Principles, which held that citizens could be held accountable in situations where crimes against humanity were taking place and they did nothing to stop those crimes. And so I don't want to be considered complicit in the violation of human rights. And as a citizen of Santa Cruz, that it may seem like kind of a long stretch of the concept of the Nuremberg Principles, but to me it's an extension of the Nuremberg Principles that should be put forward, just as in the case where people who have tried to stop the development of nuclear weapons and to stop the first strike systems have used the Nuremberg Principles, an extension to the idea that no citizen should allow such crimes to continue.
Okay, thank you very much. And we've got a caller. Please tell us what you're thinking. Hello.
Hi, I was wondering.
Hello?
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 Hello.
Okay. Okay, go ahead.
Okay,
All right, we've been hung up on yet again.
Maybe a studio problem.
Good gosh. Oh, okay. That was sort of an error. Please, if you're going to call in, please talk to us. It's very upsetting.
It's a conspiracy.
It very well could be.
If they don't talk to us, we'll just keep talking to them. That'll be their punishment.
Please, call in. It's 429-4036. If you have anything constructive to say or anything destructive to say, just if you have something to say, this is your chance to air your opinion. I understand that one of the main stumbling blocks for the homeless activists are the store owners on the Pacific Garden Mall. Who has to say anything on that?
We haven't heard much from the store owners lately. They're kind of a shadow force. In other words, you talk to city council members on the rare occasions when they consent to talk to us. Looks like you got a call coming in. Maybe you should grab it.
Okay.
Talk
All right. Please talk to us. Don't hang up. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm Betsy. I'm in Santa Cruz, and I just happened to hear your program. And I guess I'm not going to be a positive call, but I just wanted to say that I do not support sleeping. I have relatives that live in Ocean Street, and homeless people are sleeping and camping out there, and it's dangerous. They leave their trash and their, human deposits everywhere. And
everywhere?
Well, where they shouldn't be. When you're taking a walk and you see toilet paper and trash and garbage, and you see people sleeping, and it's scary, you can't walk where you want to walk, down the road, and they're walking around at night. And, I know that there's people that are mentally ill and people that need help, and I support helping those people. But I don't think allowing people to sleep in the streets or sleep, maybe have a camp or something, but I don't think legalizing sleeping is just the way to do it.
Okay. How many would you estimate are mentally ill?
I don't know, probably But I don't, those people need help, but I don't think, you know, legalizing sleeping is the way to do it, because I don't, you know, I don't want to see people sleeping on the streets.
Okay. Stay on the line, and we'll get to that. Who wants to answer that?
Well, I just want to say that I can respect your opinion as a person who does reside in Santa Cruz. However, I feel that, you know, the homeless people, I notice a lot when you're talking, you keep saying they. It's kind of like separating them from us. And they're not separate from us. They are human beings. And I think that a lot of the fear that is bred among people is from ignorance of the homeless. There's a lot of misconceptions. Just because there are people on the streets doesn't necessarily mean they're going to harass you or anything like that.
Well, you know, I have been harassed, and, you know, I have been harassed before. Every time you walk down the mall, those people want to give you the pamphlets, and you say you're not interested, and they call you names, and they yell at you like, you know, you're too good for us, and that's not it at all. I don't want to support the band, and they've asked me when you walk down the mall, you know, we're always getting asked by the stand, they always yell at you and things like that, and I'm an open-minded person, but I sit down Ocean Street, you go down there and you see people walking around late at night, and they're not wholesome people, a lot of them are, and I do know that they're people, and I'm not making them an ambiguous term or, you know, separating them from myself, but I do think that I do not like it, and I don't think it's safe. And I don't think it's good. And I think, you know, I pay for my house and I pay my property taxes, and I think I should be able to, when I own my property, I shouldn't have to walk down the street and see a bunch of people leaving their trash and living in my backyard. And I don't want to have to walk down the street at night and worry that I'm going to get attacked. And there have been people that have been attacked on my street, and it's a very serious problem. And if you don't have to live with it, it's different. But, you know, even... it's a bad area down there at night.
Well, that's why we want to try to...
down there will tell you the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why we're trying to establish some kind of campsites for the problem.
That's all I wanted to say, is just that, you know, I don't think it's fair to throw people, you know, just disregard people because they're not the norm of society or because they don't match what we think they should be. But I don't think it's fair just because somebody, even the ones that are meant to chooses to live like that, should be allowed to just sleep wherever they want and impose their choice of lifestyle on other people, and I think that's what I don't like about it, okay?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Sure, thank you.
Okay, well...
respond to that, David.
Okay,
I think Ray wanted to say something.
Well, actually, I have a much longer response, which I would like to give later, but... let me say that I very much welcome that call, not only because it was somebody who was able to get through, and I see there's somebody else trying to get through right now, but it did
please,
address
please
the problems.
Please hold on, caller. Please hold on.
Yeah. It brought up some issues and some problems that we cannot go into a denial posture on and just sweep under the rug, and I would like to be able to address some of the particulars that she was talking about.
Maybe
after this call.
Okay. Please call or talk to us and tell us what you're thinking. You're on Hearing Voices. Hello.
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 I wanted to disagree with the last caller. I can sympathize with her her feelings about wanting to feel protected or secure. I understand some of those fears that become, that get there because of people being around late at night, and it's sort of an unusual thing for people to be seeing. But in many parts of the world, people are sleeping in doorways all the time. When I lived in Calcutta for a short time, it was commonplace to see people sleeping everywhere. Not that we should try to duplicate what they're doing in Calcutta, but to some extent that's going on as the lines get drawn between those who have and those don't. There's an increasing amount of poverty in this country, and more of those symptoms of that are really apparent in countries like India and like in Calcutta, they're starting to become apparent here too, because we have not honored a value that we are together in this economy and we're together in this society, and that we owe a responsibility to one another to make it work for everyone. Instead, what we've done is we've accepted the basic premise that I don't want to see those people. Like somehow we're exclusively placing ourselves in a position of deciding other people's fate.
Actually, that brings to mind the situation in San Francisco, where there were protests to the food giveaways in the park, down the street on Haight, and one woman complained saying that she didn't want her kids having to see homeless people get food for free.
That's part of the problem. It represents a lack of holding certain values dear among us. And one of them is that people, everyone, deserves a place to have a place to sleep that's warm and comfortable. They're never going to be able to reach any form of personal esteem or employability or anything if they're still, you know, worn out from walking around all night because they can't find places to sleep or nothing's been set aside for them. And whether it's in Santa Cruz or anywhere in the country, if we don't start providing homes for people who are being displaced because they lose their jobs or their houses get foreclosed or whatever, and this situation certainly is going to get worse as we start to deal with some of the economics of the next few years. The problem is going to get much worse, and so people who are screaming and complaining now should really get it figured out in their head that there's something else going to have to be done here besides complaining and whining about people who are homeless in their street. They're going to have to deal in a really fundamental way with the whole problem of homelessness and how it's coming about through our economics. And in some countries, like in South Africa, they deal with the problem by putting them in bantustans or putting them in this country in ghettos. Now, we have chosen to deal with the problem like that in the past, and I suppose that to some extent that's what they're suggesting now by putting these camps or whatever out so that at least people have a place to stay that they're out of view. Now, I can sympathize with the business community in the sense that it doesn't provide a very attractive sort of environment for shopping and that kind of thing to have so many people homeless walking the streets downtown. But at the same time, we really have to take a deeper look at what's going on here and not just kind of have knee-jerk reaction to the problem. And as much as I've supported the city council and some of the progressive things that they have done, they have really fallen down when it comes to this whole problem of dealing with the homelessness. They've certainly done more than most communities, and they're to be applauded for that. But in general, their whole attitude about the homelessness problem, I guess, recognizes that it's a much deeper problem than they can handle on a local level without more funds. I suppose that's part of it. But there certainly could be given more support towards trying to come up with some solution that's going to at least give people a place to sleep.
Okay, caller. Thank you for your opinions.
All right,
thank you. Okay, we're going to take a short break now, and then we're going to address some of the things that that caller just brought up. Remember, you're listening to Hearing Voices. Okay, we've got another caller, but we're going to take a short break now, so you can hold on or you can call back. It's only going to be about 2.5 minutes or so. So you are listening to Hearing Voices on KZSC in Santa Cruz, 88.1 at the far left of your dial. Okay, you're listening to Hearing Voices. They brought up the camping sites. Does anyone want to address that?
And they also brought up the previous caller brought up the problem of what do you do with human waste and litter and the problem of privacy and bizarre-looking people suddenly in your way and weirdos at tables yelling out take pamphlets and so forth. I usually have a quick response to that, maybe too quick, in that you don't need a sleeping law to deal with a littering problem. You don't need a sleeping law to deal with a sanitation problem. There are laws that say if somebody is crapping on your front doorstep, you can do something about it. If somebody is sleeping on your front doorstep, for that matter, that's trespass. And if somebody is blocking the sidewalk, there's an ordinance for that. That's obstructing the sidewalk. What you don't want to have, at least what I don't want to have, is a broad-based ordinance for harassing people to sleep anywhere and everywhere in the city. Conceivably, and we're thinking of proposing this to the city council, part of the city could be zoned for not sleeping. It could be neighborhoods such as the neighborhood Betsy lives in. Perhaps there people are particularly sensitive. They don't want to see people sleeping. Then there could be other areas where people could sleep. Now, frankly, temperamentally, I favor Charles' position, which is if somebody has to sleep and is not doing anything other than sleeping, you shouldn't penalize them for that alone. And that's what this law, this 6.36010, does. It is a so-called camping ban that's actually a sleeping ban. So in response to Betsy, I'd say you don't have to favor this keeping the sleeping ban in order to make sure that people don't litter the area or sleep on your property. That's a myth that's been spread by the city council. Several times Mike Rotkin and John Laird have misstated our position. We want people to be able to sleep in the streets. No, I don't think particularly I want people to be able to sleep in the streets. I just don't think people should be arrested for sleeping in Santa Cruz just for that reason alone. If you're sleeping in the streets, you're obstructing something usually, and that's the basis for a policeman asking you to move along and go somewhere else.
It seemed to me that both callers were potential allies for you, mm-hmm. because the first caller, she said she wanted some kind of a campsite, some place where, you know, out of sight, out of mind could happen. And the second caller, you know, was an avid proponent of camping sites.
Did I say something about that
certainly.
Out of sight, out of mind point? I think a lot of people feel that way. And whenever we have a large group of people that somehow are viewed as a problem to other folks, one of their ways of solving the problem is trying to get them out of sight. And that itself is a really sad way of resolving the value, whatever value conflicts are involved. And because we put people out of sight by putting them in prison, we put people out of sight by sticking them in mental hospitals. And now there would be some forms of campgrounds which would do that same thing. And actually, I feel that the homeless people congregating on the mall, if it wasn't for the fact that they congregated on the mall, this town would probably never face the problem and do something about it. So I'm not really in favor of solutions that put people out of sight. And I'm hoping that if campsites are designated, that they will not have that effect, and that there will be enough of them so that people can even choose the neighborhoods they wish to sleep in, not be put in just one single kind of a ghetto.
Okay, we have a caller on the line. Hello, caller.
Yes, I'm still here. First of all, I just want to say I'm very sympathetic to the cause here, the situation. What are your concerns regarding the possibility of a sudden increase or migrant population of the homeless if such a campsite were to be established in the area? I'm not implying that more people would take advantage, so to speak, and quit their jobs and go out and live in this campsite, but is it not, in a sense, provoking more of a sense of freedom to not do what I guess we're trying to oppose upon homeless people by not doing something like that? What are your concerns as far as people taking advantage of something like that? I do remember what happened in Los Angeles recently in the last couple of years, the big big city that they erected down there, and the cops came in and tore it all down. I mean, that was tragic. But do you foresee something like that possibly happening? Do you intend to get absolutely every foreseeable loophole, legal and otherwise, out of the way so that absolutely nothing could get in the way of this?
Anyone?
My thought is, usually, again, I've had this question's been asked me before, and I haven't done an extensive survey of areas that have changed their laws and then seen what the results have been. A frequent argument is there will be a magnet effect. Oh, if we treat people fairly, everybody will come here, you know, this sort of thing. There have been two cases. One is in San Francisco, where there has been a policy for many years of letting people sleep in their vehicles, which was suddenly changed in January due to the police attempt to embarrass the new mayor, Art Agnos. After that, the mayor responded by declaring a moratorium on the enforcement of the law officially. The law stated you can't sleep in your vehicle or eat in your vehicle after 10 o'clock at night, between 10 and 6 in the morning, or you get a misdemeanor ticket, which is a $1,000 fine, 6 months in jail, such as Maria and I are facing here for sleeping. But what happened then was there was an association that formed called the Vehicular Residents Association to defend the rights of people.
Oh, golly. It appears that our phone are hung up.
Oh, okay. Should I continue?
Please.
Sure. Yeah. Who this association attempted to defend the rights of people in their vehicles, and they did a survey, and they found that 2 months, perhaps it was one month or 2 months after the moratorium was officially declared on the enforcement of the law, so that San Francisco was free for people who lived in their vehicles, the number of vehicles that were in the city in the hate area had increased by a grand total of one. One vehicle had arrived. In Santa Barbara in 1986, there was a change in the sleeping law there. They, after a very conservative city council refused any kind of dialogue with homeless activists, and homeless activists were being arrested nightly for sleeping in or alternately for walking around and then collapsing and being taken to hospitals. It was a much more militant movement than our movement is here. The city council responded with constant denials. Finally, there was a nationwide call to the homeless to come to Santa Barbara by Mitch Snyder's organization. And 2 weeks before the date for the homeless to arrive, the city council capitulated there and said, fine, we'll change the law. They changed the sleeping law. They liberalized it considerably, so busts are down 75% as of this year, according to a conversation I had with one of the attorneys down there. His name is Will Hastings. And they found no appreciable increase, according to him, in people coming into the city. So in Santa Barbara, which is somewhat closer to a larger area, I mean, you have a huge area of Los Angeles and down there, if it's a mecca, this kind of change in the law did not produce that kind of response there, nor did it produce such a response in San Francisco among van dwellers. Now, who knows? One can't say what would happen here. It's a different situation. Santa Cruz is unique. But I think that the argument have to be made that this is really going to happen. And I think an experimental period where the ban is lifted in a part of the city would be a way to try it out. I mean, if you see a huge number of people coming to town, then that will be a problem that will have to be faced. But I don't anticipate that myself.
I'd like to respond to it in a somewhat different way, although I'm supporting what Robert Nurse is saying. It seems to me that whenever the appropriate question or challenge or inquiry is made as to what is going to be the cost of doing the right thing. And oftentimes we have horrendous potential consequences laid out as if you do the morally correct thing, then such and such will happen, and we certainly can't have that. One is to put it in the perspective of real facts and experiences Robert has and say, well, no, wait a second. Those concerns have been largely exaggerated or do not materialize when put in practice. But the other response I think we need to make, and I think we need to be very, very clear about this, both as individual human beings with consciences and as a community, is that we cannot guarantee that doing the right thing will always come for free. there has to come a point where you do the right thing because it has to be done, and where you will be moral because that's the kind of person or community you choose to be. And if problems arise out of that, then rather than going back to the idea of, no, well, we better go back and persecute people so we don't end up with these problems, it seems to me that the more human approach is to say, if trying to become moral about a situation means that problems are created, then let's address those problems in turn. I've used the phrase that we should become a magnet. We should become a moral magnet. We should go ahead and try solving these problems at a human level. And if that compounds certain difficulties, then let us celebrate the fact that we get to then explore the next stage of becoming moral human beings. We have just witnessed the kind of escapism of the Dukakis campaign, where clearly the preferable to two sides tries to avoid all moral questions at virtually all costs, and it's a defeatist approach to life. It's a defeatist approach to public policy. It just constantly gives more and more to the forces of nihilism, and we cannot afford that. So I would say, let's do what we must do, and if complications there be, then let's address those next, and we'll have to have the goodwill of all the people to work on that, including all the callers that have come in so far. I don't want to be polarizing or categorizing them into good and bad people. I think we can make use of the positive parts of all these calls.
Okay. One of the sites that has been speculated on for a camping area, should anyone allow that to happen, is up here on campus at UCSC. Would either Maria or Jenny like to answer that and see what has happened with campus administration?
Well, I think it'd be a really good idea since we do have a lot of open land that could be available. However, I really don't know how practical, or in a sense I think it might be a little bit idealistic, because I honestly don't think that the chancellor is going to just give land that readily, because you have to keep in mind that, you know, living society we are living in, that in a sense we're trying to sell the campus, and that might be somebody might look at people sleeping out there and just be totally turned off. So I don't know what his viewpoints are on that, but that's one of them that I'm looking at, that he might, that might be a feeling that will come from that. I think it's an excellent idea. However, I would really have to sit down and speak with the chancellor about it, which hasn't been done at this point.
Okay, there is a...
something about that?
I was just going to say that there is a fairly large number of students living in the woods.
In the woods,
campus.
Yes.
43, I hear, something like that.
I'm not sure of the numbers, but I do know people do live out in the woods.
All right, we've got a phone call. listening to Hearing Voices, we're talking about the homeless issues in Santa Cruz. Please tell us what you're thinking. Hello.
Good early afternoon. There's one question I wanted to ask. But generally in the continental United States, per se, is if you go back, maybe looking back the last 25 years, it seems to have multiplied to an alarming degree. And I was wondering, what do you have any statistics about that, any information about that?
Well, I know that the homeless issue is the second largest national problem that America faces, right underneath the deficit.
How much has it increased maybe over the last two decades? It seems to me, I'm not an expert on this or anything, but from my memories, I'm 37, going back over the last 20 years, that it's increased a lot in the state of California.
I could say something about that more nationally. I think two decades ago, there was very little homelessness in the United States. And three or four decades ago, the poor could shelter themselves, because we hadn't saddled ourselves with the oppression of the building codes that intimidates people and prevents them from sheltering themselves when they are unable to find shelter in the regular marketplace.
Another thing that I'd like to bring up is the fact that there are the prices of real estate in many areas seem to be artificially inflated, because if you buy a house in many parts of California, your mortgage payments, your cost of mortgage, taxes, and insurance are going to exceed the level that you are, the income that you are likely to be able to rent it out for. If you can manage to buy a house at this time today. And on that point, something should be done or speeded up in a legislative process to make, really inexpensive housing available to these people. And there should be a lot of creative things that could be done if it legally were allowed. I'll get off now. Thank you.
I'd like to make a response to some of the historical perspectives the last caller brought in. And starting with the perspective that the so-called homeless are really not all of one stereotype, but that is composed of many, many different kinds of populations. It's something that we're all aware of in this room, certainly. But let me address some of the kinds of populations that are included and how they've been differently impacted upon in an historical perspective. Let's start off with a significant component of the mentally ill. During the 1960s, there was a coalition between liberal viewpoints, and here I'm including genuinely liberal and also as part of that libertarian kinds of concepts, of people who were offended by a lot of the abuses of psychiatric institutionalization and warehousing of many, many people in the large state hospitals with poor levels of care and that did not need to be so institutionalized. Coalition between them and some fiscal conservatives, including Ronald Reagan when he was governor of the state of California. And so at that time, there was a social and political movement that met with a good deal of success, and it carried forth also into the 70s to deinstitutionalize the mentally ill from the large warehousing kind of state hospitals. That was sold in, for example, in California under the Short Doyle legislation of 1966, a very enlightened piece of legislation that then-Governor Ronald Reagan signed. And it was coupled with the idea of providing lots of local program supports for these people. So we'd get them out of the hospital, into the community, and with the appropriate supports that would make it feasible and not an undue burden on the community and also add quality to their lives. Well, Reagan accomplished the first part of deinstitutionalizing from the mental hospitals, and then he yanked the rug out from under the local services. And so then we had, for example, mental illness ghettos like the area around San Jose State College, which became like a schizophrenic ghetto in a lot of ways. And that contributed dramatically to the homeless problem, and it has increased over the years. That's one facet. A second facet is that with, particularly during the Reagan era, but also preceding the Reagan era, we have had a cutback in welfare programs and welfare support programs. I heard a statistic the other day regarding, I don't know whether it was Medicare or Medi-Cal, but it's true of benefit programs across the board. Apparently, of all the applications that were denied, an audit was done, only 26% of those applications were legally denied, under where the people were ineligible, even under the stingy, niggardly regulations that we now have, which under the state and federal regulations, that three-quarters of the people that are denied welfare are people who are eligible even under their own standards. Many of those people, including oftentimes women with children, will end up literally out on the streets or out in the woods because they cannot find they cannot get the benefit checks to which they're entitled and have to scramble in other ways. And with this hostility toward the poor and the hostility with which many of the welfare programs are administered, both for on SSI and the Social Security programs, AFDC, general assistance, we've been going backwards, and that's been increasing the problem on homeless. And then thirdly, as the caller pointed out, the scene on real estate has been tailored primarily for the speculators, as well as, of course, there are environmental stresses. So these are some of the historical inputs that we have to treat and deal with. And but this city council that we've been experiencing in the last 2 years has been acknowledging some of this, but what they justify their persecution of the poor in Santa Cruz by saying, well, there are these larger causes, and therefore we can't do anything about it until the larger picture, that is Congress, starts doing something about their part of the house. Well, that's true. The problem will not be solved until it's solved in the larger part. But that is no excuse for aggravating the persecution of those who are within our community, who are suffering from that larger picture, as well as from the smaller picture that's been visited upon us by this past city council.
Well, our first caller said that she estimated that about half of the homeless in Santa Cruz are mentally disturbed. And President-elect, God help us all, George Bush, said that he said in one of his speeches that most of the homeless are mentally ill. Robert, as far as you know, how many of the homeless that you personally know, how many would you say, how many would you estimate are mentally disturbed?
Well, again, that's kind of a phrase that I don't to put too much stock in. I think people, you know, have different approaches, different lifestyles, and some people are disabled in some senses. I would estimate people I regard as real weird or hypersensitive or kind of autistic or something like that, and the way they approach me, I'd say it's a relatively small minority. I'd say no more than 20 or 30% at most is my feeling. Again, a lot of people who perhaps others would regard as wild and crazy, I mean, they work on the table, for example. And they, I think there's a higher percentage of people who are drunks than there are people who are mentally disturbed in the sense of people I regard as impossible to work with because they won't talk to me or they won't communicate. Actually, you find the more you're out on the streets, the more people will talk to you. And because they become familiar with you, you become familiar with them. They might not like you, and you might not like them, but you establish a working basis of communication. I think this fear of that people have going downtown that Betsy talks about, and the fear that's trumpeted about there being a huge problem, the business problem you were talking about before, that the number of conservative candidates for city council use this excuse or this claim that they're going to clean up the mall by removing the street people or by enforcing the law, or in Randall Kane's case, by reinstituting certain discredited policies from the German government of the 30s. Perhaps he was misquoted on this. This whole approach, I think, misses the point. I mean, the point is the problem that the downtown businesses concern things like high prices, appealing to a different market than the local market. I mean, you can't get a... I continue to repeat this when people ask me this, but you can't get a decent salad bar there, whereas out on 41st Avenue you can get a huge salad, all you can eat, for $3 or $4. It's parking problems, stuff like that.
So
you have a caller? I regard that as largely a blind. I mean, you know, business people have legitimate concerns about their businesses, and I think businesses could work with people on the streets. In some cases, they're just afraid to. I mean, I've talked to business owners who had one or two bad experiences, and they do not want to subject themselves to any further contacts. But, I mean, you know, America is not a Disneyland shopping mall. It is a real community of people with real problems, and those are going to spill out probably more and more in the years ahead. And they have to be dealt with on a human basis. And I think one of the things in the petition for homeless rights, a petition given to the city council in June that they have not responded to, even though there are thousands of signatures from local people on it, is to urge that a committee an arbitration committee be put together to deal with problems between business people and street people on a non-coercive basis. Rather than calling the police, there should be some kind of mediating agency, as, for example, we have a mediating agency for rent problems.
Okay. Once again, you're listening to Hearing Voices. We're talking about the rights of the homeless and homeless activism in Santa Cruz. You're listening to KZSC Santa Cruz, and I'm Dave, and we have to fill you in on some news because the FCC makes us. Okay, Bethany College in Scotts Valley will present the play Tartuffe on November 10th, 11th, and 12th. Oh, good grief. Okay, caller, sorry we didn't get to you immediately, but you can call back. Bethany College in Scotts Valley will present the play Tartuffe on November 10th, 11th, and 12th, which means you can catch it tonight and tomorrow night, and then again next weekend, the 17th, 18th, and 19th, at the Bethany Theater, 800 Bethany Drive in Scotts Valley. How many times did they say Bethany in that? This hilarious 17th century comedy about a religious hypocrite who's only in it for the bucks, is as timely and funny today as it was in the court of Louis the 14th. You'll never forgive yourself if you miss Tartuffe. For more information and for reservations, call 438-3800. And yet another bit of news. The Art Center Theater is available for rental for production or special events. Santa Cruz County Actors Theater manages this comfortable, well-equipped 97-seat playhouse. Please keep us in mind for recitals, lectures, meetings, or special performances. For more information, call 425-7529. Okay. Once again, you're listening to Hearing Voices. We have a caller on the line, but first the FCC makes us do this as well.
Listen up. This is for your own good. The following program contains material of a sensitive, controversial, or sexual nature which may offend some members of the audience. The views expressed reflect those of the speaker only and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of KZSC or the UC Regents. Anyone who prefers not to hear this type of material should tune out KZSC for an indeterminate amount of time and join us later. Thank you very much.
Dreamed of riding horses, roping and herding cats.
Okay, once again, you're listening to Hearing Voices, and this is KZSC 88.1 on your FM dial. And I'd like to invite you to stick around for Down by Law following this. Okay, we have a caller that we have to get to, and you're on Hearing Voices. Please tell us what you're thinking. Hello.
Hello, yes.
Yo.
It seems like in a town that projects itself as progressive, and with the university, I hear that some really creative solutions could come about. And it's really kind of funny that isn't happening. You know, there's what's disturbing on one level is with the choices that people made with Bush, and this kind of mandate of punishing those that don't have, and what appears to be following the same mandate in Santa Cruz with a police action. It's really sad because it's not a problem. It's like a tumor, having a tumor on your body and just thinking that if you forget about it or something, it will go away, rather than really dealing with it. And it seems to be the prevalent social and political attitude in this country, which growing up through the Christian doctrine, I see as kind of the armchair compassion that's what's really practiced in this country, rather than the actual following through with Christian principles, which means sharing with those that have less and under the leaves of Yeats, things like that are supposedly the keystones of Christianity. And yet, in fact, with this Christian nation, it's like push them aside. They're not us. Get them out of the way. We don't put them in jail. Whatever. It's so, as someone on the panel mentioned, they're completely self-defeating. I mean, they have so much, you know. And I guess they're so obsessed with hoarding everything and thinking that that's some kind of safety or security. What if they just had, you know, use a little bit of imagination or creative intelligence, they would see that by sharing with others and helping others, they're helping themselves, and they could still have their, you know, fancy cars and clothes and champagne dinners. And they just, you know, I mean, that's maybe why the 10% you know, sharing thing has come down to a lot of religions. But just sharing a portion, and then everyone gets fed and clothed. And it's really appalling to hear people in this country look down on people that are less fortunate than them, or label them as mentally ill. I mean, what does that really mean? Who is it mentally ill on some level? Or mentally disturbed or emotionally disturbed. And why are they that way? You know, they're less fortunate circumstances or whatever. And it seems like without any real genuine leadership in this country, kind of along the lines that Jackson was offering or putting forth, there's nothing coming from the top or whatever to lead in this direction. So it kind of polarizes in this punishment way, and it's really bad. It stymies me how you know, in this town particularly, that people call themselves progressive and yet just want to brush it aside. I don't understand. Maybe someone there can help me.
Okay.
I'd like to comment on that. I appreciate the values that this last caller expressed. I feel much the same way myself. I feel that one of the reasons for this polarization is partly because of the increasing gap between the rich and the poor economically, so that the rich simply have no comprehension for what it's like to be poor. And so they begin to view the poor as somehow less than human. And I think in this town, folks in the community who have some apprehension, who have kind of accepted some of the stereotypes about the homeless, might challenge themselves to get acquainted with some of the homeless folks. It's not hard to do because there are usually homeless people on the mall, and they're often quite happy to talk. And I think getting acquainted is a way of overcoming some of the fear that is so much a part of this problem. And until that fear is, until we as individuals kind of deal with that fear, why I think the community is not going to take appropriate action. I think there are a lot of creative possibilities. And once the fear is overcome, I think those creative possibilities will become apparent.
Okay. I think the caller touched on the progressiveness of the city and the city council. And earlier a caller said that the city council has done something, but they haven't gone far enough. Would anyone like to express an opinion on that?
Yeah, I would. I'd like to do some follow-up about my comment that certain actions of the city were fascistic, and I have reason to believe that the city council was involved in that. And I want to make a distinction so it's not just getting off into rhetoric. When I label an action as fascistic, I am not labeling everybody behind that action as being a fascist. I think that the progressives in our city council, our past city council, and a lot of other progressives in this community are really, by and large, very fine people. And for example, people like Mike Rotkin, whom I'm extremely critical of in this context, I have known as as a really fine person in a lot of ways. In fact, indeed, I've had the privilege of having him as a client at one point. So I want to make a distinction, first of all, between labeling actions and effects of programs on the one hand versus how we deal with people on the other hand.
And I don't think that we are well served by polarizing the community into those people who are somehow heroes and those people who are somehow villains. I do think, however, that we need a militancy on the issues, and that it is not going to be well served by just trying to have people look the other way. And so, for example, to illustrate some of this militancy, the last person said that the last caller said the stupidest people are the rich. I totally disagree with that statement. I think the stupidest people are those of us in the society at large who allow them to remain rich. What the rich people, by and large, are aware of, their cleverness, at least in the short run, and that short run may be at least several decades, if not centuries, is that we constantly fawn at the fantasy that we could somehow be rich too. All we have to do is win the lottery or get through some get-rich-quick scheme or another, and then we can be part of the elite. And because we have that fantasy, we buy into the idea that it's okay for the world to be ruled by rich people. And that is nonsense, but it's worked. And it'll continue working until we decide that life is really about more important things than gathering wealth and baubles. And that we have each other to work with and ourselves and our self-respect, and we can get around to solving these problems. Now, so that's one thing. I have more I want to go off on, but I think I should let some of the other people say some things.
Well, just for our listeners' benefit, could we all introduce ourselves again? I'm Dave, and I'm the host of the show.
I'm Robert. I'm a homeless activist and the proud author of the Petition for Homeless Rights.
I'm Ray Grunike. I'm, as introduced by Robert, one of the local shysters, and I've had the privilege of representing many homeless in the courtroom.
Okay, I'm Jenny Kenley, and I go to school here at Santa Cruz, and right now I'm trying to form an organization, Student Alliance for the Homeless on campus.
And I'm Maria Alderetti, and I also am a part of the Student Alliance for the Homeless.
I'm Charles Gray. I'm one of the defendants in the cases in the courts around the sleeping ban.
Okay.
I wanted to just make a comment. I think Ray's got some important things to say. I just wanted to butt in briefly in response to your question, which was about what has the city council been doing, or what exactly was your question again? It was
what have they done and what haven't they done?
What have they done? Well, actually, it's hard for me to give a totally fair and knowledgeable assessment of what they have and haven't done, because I've been pretty much focusing on the abuses that they have been permitting and endorsing, namely arresting people for sleeping after 11 o'clock at night in the city, where it is currently illegal everywhere in the city, without exception if you are outside of a house or hotel, to sleep, even on your own property or in your own vehicle. This is the absurdity that we continue to try to change with the kinds of demonstrations we've been doing and sleep-ins we've been doing, because ordinary representations to the city council have no effect. We have urged them to deal with a petition on the matter, and they have declined to even take up the petition formally. We presented them with the petition in June, as I mentioned before. Since, we have gathered thousands more signatures on this petition, urging essentially that they make a minor change, that they allow people to sleep in their vehicles in the city limits unless there is a complaint. I actually believe people should be allowed to sleep wherever, provided they're not a public nuisance. That's an important proviso, but provided they're not a public nuisance, and provided they're not littering, provided there isn't some other crime in progress. But the petition that we presented to the city council was a very limited thing. It just asked that the city council consider changing the law regarding sleeping in your car. Their own Human Relations Task Force, a group that they had appointed a year and a half ago, presented them with a report. The task force was headed by Jane Yokoyama, who has recently been the top vote-getter elected in the city council. She's a new city council member. They gave her 3 minutes of discussion and voted her down. This is a progressive majority. Progressive city council at the time, they had a majority of 4, and they now have a majority of 5. And it remains to be seen whether the new candidates, Mo Reisch, Don Lane, and Jane Yokoyama, as well as the former mayor, John Mahaney, who's a conservative, will be willing to take some action on changing this crazy sleeping ban.
during their campaigns, they made some positive statements. Mo Reisch said, for instance, that he favored a moratorium on ticketing until the issue could be dealt with. That is, he favored ending the practice of ticketing people for sleeping, at least for a period of time while the issue could be worked out, provided, he said, that demonstrators did not raise their voices in raucous and alienating ways at the city council. He was particularly concerned about the mayor being called nasty names and homophobic names at that, which I don't particularly support, but I feel that compared to the issue of harassing someone for sleep, it's a rather... It pales in comparison. If you're arresting people for sleeping every night, you naturally should expect a few nasty names to appear at the city council one time or another. In fact, you'd have a sedated citizenry if they didn't. Anyway, Reisch proposed this, that there be this change. Jane Yokoyama has proposed that there be that a solution be implemented of some sort, such as opening the National Armory, which is I wouldn't mind. It's just it depends on the governor, and it's not something that she takes responsibility for in terms of an action that the city can take. And finally, Don Lane has proposed that there be campgrounds opened on county property. He was thinking of a county building, if I'm not misquoting him, which again is fine, but it doesn't commit him to do anything. But perhaps these new members will be able to have some impact on John Laird and Marty Wormhout, kind of the old-timers on the council, to actually come up with some kind of reasonable suggestions that can put us in a position where we don't need to continue the kind of massive demonstrations that we have been engaging in, and quite frankly, that I think will continue until there is some action taken. The weather has gotten nasty. It is raining out there, and people are getting soaked and wet. And even though there is a satellite shelter program that does provide for a certain number of beds each night for people who can get down to the crossing the UPS yard, I think it's at 6:15 every night, and I urge people who are homeless and who can hear this to use these facilities if they want. People shouldn't be arrested for sleeping, and it's as simple as that. And they shouldn't be ticketed for it, and they shouldn't be hassled for it. And I'm hoping that the city council will take some action on it. But up to now, they have not listened to us at all. They have been unwilling to discuss it, and because of that, we've had to demonstrate.
We should acknowledge a particular positive thing that the City Council has done, which is the 14-bed River Street shelter, which has been put in, 10 beds of which are reserved for the mentally ill. That in itself is a positive thing. It was done after a great deal of organizing effort, etc. However, it is not an unmitigated positive thing. There are two negative drawbacks on it, at least, if not three. One is that achievement has been used oftentimes as a token to try staving off addressing the larger problem. 14 is not the number of homeless in Santa Cruz. I don't know the precise number, but it's probably around 1,500.
I think it's 2,000.
Well, okay, so we're certainly in a different kind of dimension than 14. Second, it has been organized in such a fashion, so as liberals have traditionally organized social service programs, so as to emphasize the delivery of salaries to those who would help those in need, and to give short shrift to the actual delivery of services to those in need. And that's, you know, I'm not even necessarily talking about whether the particular administrators have done a good or a bad job on the job, is that our priority must not be to create programs which are heavy with administrative costs and low on delivery of services. Some programs will necessarily be of that nature because of the specifics associated with them. And then the third issue is whether or not this kind of a program is going to be unduly restrictive for some of the cultural rights of people that would go through such a program. But I just also want to take issue with Robert Norris and one phrase he used, because I think it was an unfortunate understatement when he says he doesn't particularly support the homophobic attacks on John Laird. I know Robert Norris actually another area of his activism in the past and even present in the past 102 campaign has been to speak out against homophobia, and I think he was not giving himself enough credit and speaking that he doesn't just not particularly support such action. He has been a strong advocate against homophobia. But the fact that the homeless do include, and those who speak out on behalf of the homeless do include homophobic personalities, and I'm sure it includes racists and all the other kinds of negatives that are associated with our culture, that cannot be used as an excuse to go ahead and support counter-bigotries that would go ahead and persecute this sector of the population. So, yes, we will, suffer our own personal embarrassments when somebody that we're supporting comes out with racism or homophobia or something like that, but we will not allow that as an excuse to stop the movement.
All right. Any callers who want to come call in, it's 429-4036. If you have a question or if you have a comment that you want to make, positive or negative, from, I suppose, the standpoint of the homeless or your own standpoint, whatever, you can dial in 429-4036. Right now we're going to take a short music break, and we'll be right back. Okay, once again, you're listening to Hearing Voices. I'm Dave, and we're talking about homeless rights. We have a caller that we'd like to get to right about now. Talk to us, please.
Hi.
Howdy.
I was homeless for over a year in a few different counties, and I've also been considered to be clinically stressed for like a year
now. Okay, we're having a tough time hearing you. Do you have a radio on?
Getting them into hotels where everybody has cases all the time. But is it something which could be explained to some kind of self-realization of the person, whether it be as a poor person or whether it be as the way to which it won't be? That's what I wanted to say.
Okay, thank you for your comment. Okay, does anyone want to address that?
I don't know if somebody else wants to go first.
Yeah, I'd like to address that by acknowledging that there are